Good morning. I'd like to call the BATA Oversight Committee meeting of Wednesday, February 12, 2014 to order. Can we take the roll, please?
Good morning. Chair Bill Dodd?
Here.
Vice Chair Tom Bates? Absent. Commissioner Compos? Absent. Commissioner Glover?
Here.
Commissioner Pruszynski?
Here.
Commissioner Kwan?
Here.
Commissioner Sartipi?
Present.
Commissioner Tissier? Absent. Commissioner Wiener?
Present.
We have a quorum.
Thank you, Kim. Can you join me in the Pledge of Allegiance?
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, Kim, you're on.
As authorized by state law, I am making the following announcement. Each member of the board here today will be entitled to receive $100 per meeting attended, up to a maximum of $500 per month per agency. This amount is provided as a result of convening a meeting for which each member is entitled to collect such amount.
Thank you very much. Okay, we've got the consent items before us.
Move them.
We have a motion by Bates, a second by Glover. Any discussion? Any dissent? That motion passes without objection. Now move down to item number 5, Underwriting Pool Investment Banking Services. Morning, Brian.
Morning, sir. Good morning, commissioners. This is the sort of the third renewal of our financing team. That's how I know I've been here now a while, because they come every 5 years, and it's my third one. Relatively routine. We sent out a nationwide solicitation. 18 firms responded. 17 actually qualified. Of the top scoring firms, based on their responses, we invited 9 to interviews. 7 of those will make the senior team. The team itself will be broken into 3 different components. The senior pool, which is the bankers who actually will do most of the actual banking and planning and preparing the transactions, investor meetings, and things like that. Then the co-manager pool, which will be utilized in structuring and then further investor relations. And then the last group will be the support group or the selling syndicate. And they're used to get us the widest possible dispersion of investor outreaches, both retail and institutional. Agreement goes for the solicitation goes for 5 years. They are actually paid only when a successful deal is done, and that's all what they get paid is within the parameters of the resolutions you've already approved. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions, Brian?
I do.
Mayor?
Thank you. I'm sorry, since it happens every 5 years, I wasn't here the last 5 years. Do we do any social responsibility qualifications, like do they invest in the Bay Area? Do they invest in maybe some of our priority zones and transit-oriented development, et cetera?
Banking, like CRA structures like that, we do not put in. However, they are required to have both local offices and have principals within the regional area. Aside from that, no, the rest of the requirements are banking. Ability to underwrite, the ability to foster credit, the ability to sell bonds and meet investors.
Is it possible that the other transit groups would ever look at that? Because obviously we have interest in transit-oriented development, for example.
Well, every bank on the list that are national banks, not brokerage firms, actually has what's called a Community Reinvestment Act requirement. And that CRA requirement is something we can look into, and something they do actively on occasion ask me if we have needs for these things. But Community Reinvestment Act is looking into investing into local communities, into developing areas, and things like that, both businesses, housing. It is one of the more complex but elaborate components of American banking. We'll be happy to get you a rundown of what their CRA activities are, but they all do it, and they all have to do it.
Well, you know, often California and particularly Bay Area lead the rest of the country, so I can see in general we're looking at greenlining maybe for low-income communities, et cetera, but given that in many of our plans this year and given AB 32 and our whole move towards transit-oriented development and for housing, et cetera, it just seems to be something that we could look at. I know that we just signed a contract for our city services, and we looked at whether or not they are investing one in our low-income areas, but we're looking at whether they're going to we encourage them to invest along the transit corridors on the international, et cetera, because of the transit-oriented development. And possible that's where the BRT is going to go. That's where we're hoping that if we get cap and trade funds for housing, where we would put our investments. Just seeing that we're that kind of we're the agency that's supposed to be looking at that, and maybe we could help push the envelope a little bit in terms of encouraging them, or at least getting them to pay attention to the fact that we'd like to see investment in those areas. And I know that even with the recession ending, that banks are still more reluctant to lend to housing than they were before. And so that this is possibly an area where we could encourage the investment.
Well, we're a little bit behind you, but in the sense of, number one, it's more of a banking type of requirement as we do with our commercial checking accounts, credit card processing, things like that, because not all of these firms are actually commercial banks, and so they don't have CRA and other obligations like that. But yes, we've had discussions with them on these issues in the past. They're aware of your long-range transit plan. They're aware of the transit-oriented development. We've had limited but sometimes developing discussions on how they'll wind up fitting into that when those projects, when things like that come along. And we certainly do encourage it, and considering that they work for MTC and they work for the boss, he won't pass up on them.
Mayor Bates.
Yeah. Brian, this also raises the issue of where we place our money relative to the movement to divest from fossil fuel. And so, well, it's not funny. It's a real movement, because yep. If we don't get off fossil fuel, we're all doomed. And so it's just a question of not, you know, are we going to? We're going to have to, because it's inevitable. So I don't know. I know you're probably not prepared, but I think it would be important for you to come back to the Tabata with some ideas about how we might look at that in terms of, as we place our funds in firms that are in fact not, you know, fostering fossil fuel.
Which is more on the investment side than this component, which is where we usually get it. Right?
Well, I'm just saying, but this in the overall, maybe it's not directly pointed at this particular thing, but I think it's we voted to divest. We've asked CalPERS to divest. Other people, other cities, other counties, other people are looking at that, and we should look at it too.
Okay, so what we're on here is the underwriting pool for people that, you know, firms that are going to be working with us to sell our bonds, correct?
Yes.
So we that's an issue for, you know, I think for another day. But at any rate, we got a recommendation here before us right now to recommend the committee approve a pool of firms to provide the investment banking services for toll revenue financing needs for the next 5 years. May I have a motion?
Second.
Motion by Glover, second by Tissier. Any further discussion? Any dissent? That motion passes without objection. Thank you. Okay, we'll move to item number six. We've got a contract, bond counsel, and public finance counsel.
Good morning, Adrian. Commissioners.
Good morning.
This seems to be the finance day. For BATA oversight, we're coming before you to enter into a contract for bond counsel and finance counsel services. Our current counsel is Orrick Harrington and Sutcliffe. The contract expires the end of this month. To that end, we issued a request for qualifications for bond counsel and finance counsel services, and we looked for previous experience as serving as bond counsel and finance counsel for public agencies. And we also were looking at the attorneys and their qualifications on the account. We received three responses. And we interviewed two of the firms. We wanted to interview three. The third firm wasn't able to come. The two firms we interviewed were Orrick, Harrington & Sutcliffe and Nixon Peabody. Both firms interviewed very well, and we were pleased with the quality of both. But Orrick was a little bit better in terms of their experience with BATA and also the staff that they have in Sacramento and their experience with legislative matters. So for that reason, we're recommending that we enter into a five-year contract with Orrick that's up for renewal every year. The way the contract would be structured would be that they would be paid out of cost of issuance funds from bond issuances. And in addition, there would be a $200,000 per year pot available to the extent they perform finance counsel work that isn't captured in the cost of issuance payment. So we request your approval. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian. Okay, so we've got the item before us. We have a question?
Just a quick question. So we're doubling their fee. Is that because we expect them to do more work or what?
Well, since I arrived here 3.5 years ago, they've been performing more and more finance counsel work for projects that aren't directly related to bonds. For example, all the startup for express lanes and legislative matters that come up that affect BATA but not necessarily affect the toll bridge revenue bonds directly. And so this affords us the opportunity to be able to pay them for that work as it arises, although we do try to pay them out of cost of issuance. And historically, over the last 3.5 years, at least since I've been here, we have not even hit the $100,000 limit that was in the last contract. And so it's, you know, my intent to try not to hit it, but I want the flexibility, if I need it, to go there.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, any other questions, comments? May I have a motion, please? Motion, Brzezinski, second. Adrian. So we got motion, a second. Any discussion? Any dissent? That motion passes without objection. Thank you. Item number 7, we got Peter.
Mr. Chairman, I'll kick it off if you don't mind. Steve Heminger, Executive Director. We actually have quite a bit of information to share with you this morning. As you know, this bridge has been in the news lately. First of all, Andy will cover that issue, which is the question of leaks in the decks. I think he'll do so in a slightly more balanced way than the hysterical press coverage that you've been reading. Secondly, Peter is going to talk about the demolition work, which is the major remaining construction work on the project, and some of the challenges we've encountered and some of the strategies we're exploring for hastening that along. And then finally, I will cover the Senate Transportation Committee hearing that occurred about a couple weeks ago, and we included in your packet quite a bit of information from that hearing, including my testimony, the report from the committee's consultant, Roland DeWolk, whom many of you probably know from his prior life at Channel 2, and as well as a letter from Malcolm Dougherty at Caltrans responding to some of the issues that were in Roland's report. So I'll ask Andy to kick it off, and we'll go in that order and ask as many questions as you'd like.
Good morning, Commissioners. Andrew Fremier, Deputy Executive Director, Bay Area Toll Authority. As Steve mentioned, I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about the news article that came in over the weekend, as well as the various news reports that were on TV following that report. I want to sort of start out first, though, with a couple of reminders. There's quite a bit of work still going on the bridge project. We got to seismic safety opening, and we pushed off a lot of work that wasn't critical to that opening, and that work is going on. So both the contractor and the engineers are preparing punch lists, as they're called, at the final stages of construction. And so as things crop up, they will be dealt with through that punch list process through really the remainder of this year. All the way through the summer anyway. it is important, though, to recognize that Caltrans Construction eventually will hand off that project at contract acceptance to the Caltrans maintenance folks, and it's imperative that we spend as much time and effort cleaning up these problems so that we don't start with maintenance problems that we all know eventually occur as the bridge starts to age and be in use for a period of time. Also, as a reminder, BATA becomes responsible financially through the rehab program the minute the contract is accepted, so we obviously have an interest ourselves in making sure that that doesn't happen. What I'm going to try to talk about first before going into the slides is just sort of a little bit of driving around and walking through the bridge that I've done the last couple of days. I did have the opportunity to drive the bridge in both directions a couple of times during the rainstorms, and one of the more important elements with the bridge and how it operates is how it operates for the traveling public. And I think it's fair to mention that I think both directions are draining very well. That was a very heavy storm. There's no ponding. I didn't see a lot of splashing by the various, you know, as the public is driving through the bridge. And so I do think from the way it travels very nicely. I did spend some time reading the articles, and the articles talk a little bit about various things. They mention hundreds of leaks. They talk about corrosion and standing water. It also implies that there were some changes to the construction sequence in attaching the steel barrier to the bridge decks that contributed to the problem. So I spent some time taking a look at the various change orders that were related to the barrier construction. I didn't see anything that was of significance. There was several change orders related to the barriers, including changing the caulking system from non-heat resistant to heat resistant so that when the paving operations took place, they didn't affect the way the caulk worked. They did change the sequence of operations, so they placed the barrier and then caulked it. Again, I didn't think that that showed any significance. And then there were some changes where the steel turns into concrete rail at the west end, and again, really not relative to the problems that were identified in the articles. Yesterday, I went through the deck sections. I actually walked both bridges from end to end. And it's, I think, important to mention that there is no leaks happening in the welded sections. What we're really talking about is the water coming into the decks through some of the penetrations that are in the bridge boxes at the barrier rail details. And just as sort of a reminder, there's quite a few holes in the bridge relative to utilities, barrier rail bolts, and other connected items to the bridge, so there's a potential in those locations that you might get some water. The caulking is designed to resolve that. What I did notice is that the problem appears to be isolated to the north side of the bridge, and it appears to be isolated to one particular detail that is part of the barrier rail connection. It looks like it was built in accordance with the plans. It's not an area that was intended to have caulk, but I think it is an area that we need to focus some energy on because it's certainly a problem that we need to resolve. I also spent some time in the anchor chambers, and if you remember from our conversations and the work we're doing on the bolts, we are concerned about the anchor chambers. That is an area that we don't want to have water in. We've got a dehumidification system that keeps the area dry. Again, in that location, on the west direction, I did notice there was one area where there's some water. It doesn't appear to be ponded. The dehumidification system is working. The relative humidity inside that splay chamber is what it's supposed to be. So the system is working, but again, there is one area where this same detail is shown, and I'll try to show some pictures that give you a better picture of that. So again, we haven't defined several different problems. What we found is there's one particular detail that looks like it needs to have some work. I then went over to the east side splay chamber and walked through that area. There's a little bit of water there that's coming from the anchorage on the other side of the splay chamber that appears to be a very small section of failed caulking that would be a contractor-required punch list item that needs to be cleaned up. I saw no water really on the east direction all the way up, and so again, it appears to be that the prevailing storm came from the north side. There's an area where water is intruding through the barrier deck section in this one area, and that I think needs to be the focus of attention to avoid that water from entering. It's also important to mention that water is intended to drain through the bridge. So if water does come into the bridge, as much as you would like it not to, it drains through a series of weep holes and eventually goes to the low point and enters or and exits the bridge through a drain hole that's at the bottom of each of the box sections. It appears that the water is meandering through that process relatively well, but there are certain areas where it does tend to stand. And again, if we can avoid the water coming in, then there will be an elimination of any of the standing water that was shown in some of the pictures that, that we have seen. There was also a discussion or mention of corrosion. I didn't see any active corrosion in the bridge deck area. There's probably some areas of primer that need to be patched, again, as a punch list item. There's several areas that have been patched over the years. As you recall, the bridge has actually been in place for several years and has gone through several storms in that process. And again, I think any water signs that we've seen have sort of happened in a similar manner as the bridge has been standing out there. So recognizing that there is one area that there's some water intruding on the bridge, recognizing that there is quite a bit of punch list work to be done and probably some other changes that we want to make, my basic assessment is that we do need to follow up on those items, but I don't see any real significant issues that can't be handled between now and the remainder of the contract. So I'm going to apologize first for these series of pictures because they're very engineering geeky inside the bridge, but hopefully they'll tell the story a little bit better, and then I'm happy to answer any questions. So this particular slide is just looking from the bridge deck, and that's the resident engineer, Bill Casey, that's on the barrier rail. And so the barrier rail is the white form in the middle. You've got traffic on one side of it, and as you can see, there's open areas where there's connections on the back side of the rail that open, and that's actually how they lock the barrier down, and then they stick that plate on the side of the rail to seal it up. It does have a gasket. It is supposed to divert water, but it is not considered to be watertight necessarily. So water is entering somewhere in this side of the barrier rail. And so what you're looking at is the north side of the bridge. It's hard to visualize here with this picture because this is before construction was completed. And so the roadway is actually on the right side of the picture up on top, and there's construction equipment still there. It's before paving, et cetera. But this is the back end of the rail. The counterweight that is balancing the bike path is on the bottom of the drawing. And so this is, as you can see from the red area, where the water goes downslope across the bridge through the barrier rail. The engineering drawing on the bottom left is just sort of a section of what the rail looks like. The right side is where the driving surface is. The left side is the back end where you see these series of bolts and the panels on the back of the rail. Now looking inside, so we're looking directly down on the rail, and so the top part of the picture is where the traveling roadway is. The backside where the opening area is and the words north is where the panel then gets attached to it. So you're looking inside the rail. You can see why the panel is necessary. They need to lock down the barrier rail with the series of bolts that you see there, which are the gray circles. I'm going to talk about the blue circles in just a minute. And then you can also see where the roadway is cocked between the barrier rail being placed on the deck and also the vertical joints going on the top of the picture up the rail. So go to the next picture, Peter. This one is just really designed. This is an earlier shot, a little bit out of order, but I want to talk about the blue bolts that you see in the upper and the lower part of the right side of the picture. This is where we think the water intrusion is happening, and this is the only area where I could see that it was consistently happening anywhere. And water is entering the barrier rail. Again, I don't believe that's supposed to be hermetically sealed. The caulk appears to be working around the edges. The bolts that are gray don't seem to be leaking at all. But water seems to be going down these rods that are designed to actually give the barrier rail a little bit of flexibility when it gets hit. And this is the area that we need to focus some attention on to try to stop that problem from continuing. So now here's the hard ones. Now you're inside the orthotropic box section, and you're looking really from the center walkway up towards the wing. So you're looking up towards that barrier rail detail, towards the Richmond Bridge. And you've got all kinds of the structural members that are pointed out and highlighted. But the point of interest is in the upper left, where you've got that barrier rail detail on the bottom of the bridge deck. And so that's what the next couple slides are trying to indicate. A little bit more close-up view. Again, what you see is this angle plate that is shown in the upper left has a rod going through it that is tied down with the blue nut. It was added during construction as part of the original design, and it's designed to carry that rod load through the barrier rail into the strength of the deck. And that's where we're seeing the water coming through the deck up above that angle plate. This is the chief engineer, Rick Land, pointing to where we're seeing the water, and that does seem to be in many locations along the course of the bridge. If you remember, there's 13 different deck sections. This detail is repeated many times in each deck section, and when you multiply the numbers, that's where you get the hundreds of locations. But it is this one detail that seems to repeat itself throughout the course of the bridge. And it does seem to be isolated to the north side of the bridge, and probably was worse in a big storm, but it is something that you want to avoid and make sure that we don't have that water continue to go into the bridge sections. So that's the basic report, and I'd be happy to try to answer any questions if there are some.
Thank you. Just real quick, is that where he's pointing to? Is that supposed to be flush against the deck? Is that a design flaw? Or?
No, it's not supposed to be flush against the deck. That's a rod that's actually designed to flex if the barrier rail gets hit. So it's not a bearing member.
Okay. Mr. Bates?
So I'm sorry, Andy. So how are we planning to make this not happen anymore, just to prevent this from occurring?
Peter, would you go back to the one that shows the inside of the rail? I would speculate today that what you really would try to do is seal that area that is not sealed where Peter's pointing to. And that obviously is not easy from the standpoint that you've got to reopen the backside of the bridge deck or the barrier panels, and then you've got to repeat that sequence multiple times. But it appears that that's one way to avoid the water entering the deck. That seems to be the primary source, but that's what we'll be talking about over the next few weeks.
So is that an extra, or is that covered by the contract?
You know, that's a good question. My impression of reading the documents in the contract is they built what was in the plans. So if that is a problem, it's likely going to be a problem that will be required to be changed through a change order. But I don't really want to administer the contract without a little bit more discussion with the Caltrans folks.
Chair Worth.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Chair Dodd. First of all, I just want to thank our staff for their really thorough examination of this issue that's come to light, but also the presentation today, because I think it enables us to understand exactly in great detail the extent of what the issue is and also the solution. So I think it's really helpful to understand that, and recognizing too, as you indicated, that this is really part of the punch list project in terms of determining getting it ready to hand it off from construction to maintenance. So could you talk a little bit about, I know going forward, this would be part of, we're in the process of developing and this longer-term maintenance sets of protocols. So are these the kinds of the caulking that you would include in kind of a regular review of the bridge? And I was also pleased to know that your site viewing of all this determined that there was no corrosion, that it really was a matter of just updating the primer that's on that metal, and that there's a solution to dealing with this leakage problem. And also, could you talk a little bit about the amount? You mentioned that the humidifiers are working effectively. When you talk about water draining through, could you give us a little sense of when you were down there what the amount of volume of water that you saw, so we can get a sense too?
Sure. I don't want to minimize the fact that this needs to be fixed. So I would consider this probably a little bit more significant than a punch list item. I was sort of referring to the punch list item as there are some areas of the bridge that need to be kind of cleaned up as part of the normal process to make sure they're in compliance with the contract documents. This, I think, is a little bit more significant from that point of view, and that it probably requires some sort of a change. Also, where we did see some standing water in the bridge, there are certain places, just by the nature of the bridge fabrication process, that there aren't weep holes in certain areas, and they're somewhat limited. And in an area underneath the bolt hole where you don't have a weep hole for the water to drain, then we saw some standing water. And so this was a couple days after the rain that I was in there. You know, it was pooled in maybe a couple of inches where there wasn't a weep hole, so maybe that translates to a half a gallon of water or something in one isolated location. There was more water that had been working its way through the bridge, and you can see water marks because it's been, I think, doing the same thing over the course of the 2 or 3 years that it's been in place. So I'm not sure if I answered the question on volume very well, but that was sort of the observation that I saw after the rains.
So then just to follow up, so it's your assessment that the idea of increasing the caulking at these particular points should really eliminate the leakage of water really significantly?
Some sort of seal. We have several bridges that are orthotropic boxes. The Dumbarton Bridge and the Carquinez Bridge are both similar steel structures. They have concrete barrier rails. That doesn't have a penetration. Maybe this detail could have been a little bit different. They use steel because of weight. So, again, it was a design decision. It was made a while ago. Caulk will probably always be a problem. I mean, we all probably have the same problem in our showers at home, that you do have to go and replace caulk periodically. The bridge moves. It's subjected to a lot of elements. The concern I think that we share, both probably Bijan and myself, when you move into maintenance, is that the reference to, oh, it's just a maintenance problem, it's not a seismic issue, is a concern to us all, because the more that these pile up, the more difficult it is and the more work you have to do to maintain the bridges. I will say, though, that each and every bridge in the region has details that don't perform as well as they should after they've been in service a while. If you remember, we replaced and retrofitted the San Mateo Bridge a couple of years ago for a retrofit detail that didn't hold up very well and started to shake apart during activity. The same thing is true with the West Bay Bridge, where the dampers that were put in place for the seismic retrofitting have been leaking after a few years, and that needs to be fixed. Each of the bridges has sort of a story like that. I will say that inside the self-anchored suspension bridge, though, it's one of the quieter bridges I've ever been inside. You don't hear rattling. You hear very minimal noise that the bridge makes, which, you know, from the standpoint of trying to identify where things aren't working the way you should, I don't see a significant sign there. But we will be going over the maintenance manual, as has been referred to, for all the bridge sections with the Caltrans maintenance engineers, the designers, and the construction engineers over the next month or so to make sure that we're aware of the kinds of things that are being presented to us. Because as I mentioned, once this contract is accepted and the other pieces are done, it then does become both a BATA and a Caltrans maintenance responsibility.
Mr. Chairman, if I could supplement that answer, because I think this transition that we're about to undergo between construction and maintenance is quite important. And frankly, one of the most disturbing things about this issue for me is the fact, and I've confirmed this with the director of the department, that Caltrans was aware of this issue in early December. We did not become aware of it until late January. And an oversight committee can't oversee if it's not provided with information from the project staff. And I have made that clear in no uncertain terms. We have made a formal request to the department to provide us with an itemized list of every issue like this so that we know what we're getting into, and so that we can handle the bridge as it's turned over, and so that we are not handed a bunch of maintenance issues that are going to bite us in the bottom later on. Now, on the one hand, the toll payers are sort of in a position that, you know, pay me now or pay me later. We do have and have had a considerable amount of state funding in the construction program. As Andy indicated, under the law, there's no state funding in the maintenance program. So it's my intention to try to get as much of these issues dealt with in construction by the responsible parties before we get into a maintenance program where we're entirely responsible financially for maintaining the structure. So I think, you know, the issue is the issue, and as Andy has, I think, characterized it well, it's manageable, and it needs to be addressed now, not later. But we've also got a process problem that we've got to fix, because unless we have adequate communication and information, we can't do our job.
Thank you. I have one speaker card, Dave Schoenbrunn.
Mr. Chairman, we actually have more to the presentation.
Beg your pardon?
We have more to the presentation.
I'm sorry, David. Can you hang tight? Thank you. Sorry, Peter.
If you can
cut you short.
If you can sit still for a little more on the Bay Bridge, here it comes.
Peter Lee with a BATA staff. I'll try to be really brief. Basically, we're moving into a major phase with our cantilever demolition project. That's the last remaining major work going on to demolish the old existing span. And I just want to cover, you know, how that's going to be done and note some major milestones. So this is just going back in history how the original bridge was constructed, and we're going to demolish the bridge in a very similar manner. And you'll see in the pictures that the structure was built basically piece by piece and stick by stick, basically. One piece of steel coming into the shed, they lift it up, and they put it into place. And as they do, they make the final connection. It is slightly different than what we had at Carquinez. It's where we had a solid truss that we were able to lower down. In this case, we're going to change that scheme and basically reverse engineer the bridge. And this is the general layout. When it was constructed, it was one of the largest cantilever structures in the world. And we're taking this basically piece by piece. The contractor has removed the upper deck and taken that out entirely and has removed the lower deck. And now has been put into place pieces of the bridge that were originally put in when we built it in 35 as it was being constructed before it became a cantilever. And it strengthened the bridge to allow for us to, later this month, make the disconnect at mid-span to basically separate the east and the west sides of the cantilever structure. So once that's in place, we'll be able to work our way back slowly from one side. We're going to work on the Yerba Buena Island side of the bridge first because that's the closest to the new SAS, and we want to get that down as soon as possible. And as we work our way back, we'll actually be putting additional supports in the back span here on the island to support the bridge as we demolish, and we'll be basically taking it section by section as we work our way back. And then we'll do a similar process on the east span, on the east side of the structure to take that down. Would like to note, you know, there's been recent articles concerning the demolition, as we reported in the report, that we have had some challenges in the schedule. We wanted to get out a little bit earlier than we could, but with the work going on in the SAS and getting it open, we didn't let the demolition contractor get on the bridge as much as they'd like to, so we were a little delayed. We're currently, as reported in the paper, in negotiation, the pockets in negotiation with the contractor to get back as much time as we can. We're trying to do it as cost-effectively as possible and try to minimize any further delay or impacts to the remaining demolition that we have. This is just some pictures of the current work that we have. This is the upper deck removal. This is about a month or two ago where we were taking out the upper deck. This is a removing of the joist that held it up. And this is a recent picture taken from the SAS of the structure. And you see that most of this, the lower deck has been removed. And the week of February 24th is when we plan to make the disconnect and basically have two freestanding structures on either side. It's happening. I went through it really quickly. If you have any questions, I will take
any questions.
Answer.
Looks like we got it.
Sure. Or no, question
quick
quickly.
Question.
Yes. Peter, I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
So, Peter, what's happening with the steel?
The steel will be recycled. They're going to take it off and try to drive over to Schnitzer Steel over in Oakland, the port of Oakland, where they'll prep it and they'll load it onto container ships and ship it out and for recycling.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question. How far behind are we in terms of timeline?
I think we're 4 to 6 months behind at this point. What we're trying to do is minimize, because we have a couple more contracts following on. This contract is demolishing this main cantilever structure. We have two additional contracts to remove the bridge further back towards Oakland. So we're trying to we don't want to jam up too many contractors at once, but we're doing a prudent review of the schedule to make sure that we get back as much time as we can.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, just home stretch now. The last part of this presentation has to do with the Senate Transportation Committee hearing that occurred a couple of weeks ago. And I can be quite brief because many of you have lived through this history, so you don't need to hear the history lesson. But the purpose of the hearing was to discuss lessons learned from the project. And I think before it gets a little bit too stale, it's good to review the tale of the tape. Let's keep going, Peter. To me, the project really divides into two halves, and they're each about 8 years long. One is the half before the Toll Bridge Program Oversight Committee was created, and the other one is the half after. And I think the narrative that I think is too often sort of simplistically told about the project is that the two halves are the same thing, and that nothing really changed, and that all we've seen are massive delays and massive overruns in cost, when in fact that only really accurately characterizes the period before the Toll Bridge Oversight Committee was created, before this commission really had some decision-making muscle in terms of altering those trends in the project. And as you can see, and this slide just shows you the various milestones that we went through, where there was a very significant increase in cost, usually accompanied by a significant delay in delivering the project. Going from 1996, when we passed a statewide bond for $2 billion and thought $650 million would take care of the whole toll bridge seismic retrofit program, to the statute that was passed in 2005 that actually created the oversight process and established the budget that we actually lived within for the remaining 8 years, of close to $9 billion. So that's where the cost growth happened, and that's where the schedule delay happened, before, not after. What we've done here, because the numbers are so tiny, is just to try to highlight a couple of things for you. As you know, we're required under that oversight process to make a quarterly report to the state legislature. You can see in the upper left, this is from a quarterly report that we submitted soon after we were created in 2005. This one is from the spring of 2006. You will see that the budget is what they gave us. That's the first number in the sort of lower center part of the screen. And you will also see that we had established a target for trying to open the bridge to the public, the Bay Bridge in particular, of September 2013. We established that date in 2006, and that's just what we delivered in 2013. You would be hard-pressed to glean that from any newspaper reporting or, frankly, any Senate Transportation Committee hearing on the subject. But that's what happened. Now, we also, as you know, about midway through our tenure, added two new bridges to the program, the Dumbarton and Antioch Bridge, which were originally thought not to need retrofit at all. And in fact, it was the work of this commission and that committee that insisted that those two bridges be added to the Toll Bridge Seismic Retrofit Program, because it turned out they needed the work. And absent our committee's creation, I'm not at all sure that that work would have occurred. And in addition to that, what you'll notice in the summary here is that the work occurred. You'll see the two lines, the two numbers to the left are the budgets that we established for Dumbarton and Antioch, and you'll see the numbers to the right are what we delivered them for. We delivered both of them under budget and ahead of schedule. Again, a fact that you would be hard-pressed to find in a lot of press accounts. But I think this was really the best example of where the oversight process added value. With the Bay Bridge, most of the trouble and the heartache had already occurred, and we were brought in to clean up a mess. With Dumbarton and Antioch, we were the oversight process, this three-agency oversight committee. We were in charge from start to finish. from concept to completion. And that allowed us, I think, to deliver real value for the toll payers. Now, even when you explain all that, the fact is this new bridge cost $6 billion, which is a lot of money under anybody's arithmetic. I think one thing, though, to try to chop that down to size is to remember the differences between the bridge we built and the bridge we were replacing. And one obvious difference, and you just saw it in Peter's presentation, is that when the original bridge was built, there was nothing there. So there was no detour, there were no demolition costs, none of that was involved, whereas we're paying close to $800 million in detours and demolition because we had to work around the existing bridge. The next item is capital outlay support, COS. And the number that we're dealing with this new bridge is over $1 billion. It's a huge amount of money. That goes for essentially the overhead of the project, all the Caltrans engineers, all their consultants. And look, you can debate quite a bit about whether we got our value for all of that money, but the fact is that amount is about 20% of the project cost, which is not unusual. It's not out of bounds. And 20% of the original E-span cost was only $100 million. So that's another huge swing in cost from one old bridge to the new bridge. I think a lot of people don't quite appreciate either that the new bridge is 50% wider than the old bridge. You could stop 10 people on the street and I bet 9 of them wouldn't even know it. The fact is we've added traffic shoulders, we have standard lanes, and we've got a bike pedestrian path. And when you add all of that new structure, you're not replacing the old bridge. You're making the old bridge bigger by 50%. And so that accounts for a significant part of the cost difference between the old and the new. We had political delays, both in design and construction. They, frankly, were not as great a contributor to the cost difference as some of these other items, but that's still, as you can see here at the bottom, another $400 million. So when you sum it all up, and I hope this exercise has been a little bit illuminating for you, because for me it really is a way of trying to understand, you know, the E-span, the original bridge cost $73 million to build in the 1930s. That's end-to-end, Oakland to San Francisco. If you escalate that to today's money, it's $1 billion. What I've done in this analysis is just cut it in half and say it's $500 million for the east and $500 million for the west. It was probably a little bit more for the west, but for the sake of the analysis, you got $500 million on one hand and close to $6.5 billion on the other. What I've just done in this simple analysis is account for about $4.6 billion of that difference between those two numbers. And I think those are very understandable reasons why there is a difference. Some of them were avoidable. Some of them were self-inflicted. But most of them were the fact that we're building a much larger structure. We're building it in a much different regulatory environment. And we're building it around an existing bridge. What I don't account for in this analysis is the last slide, which is what are we getting for that money? We are getting far superior seismic performance. That's the reason, after all, that we're replacing the bridge in the first place. We're getting, I think, a better-looking structure. You don't get much of an argument from people about that. There are some fans of the old cantilever, but there aren't that many. You're getting double the lifespan. And remember the thing about the old bridge. It started popping eye bars a couple years ago. I mean, that bridge, we sort of coasted that bridge into the garage with fumes in the gas tank. It was not going to last much longer just in terms of its natural life. And what we're getting with the new bridge is a lifespan of double that length. We're getting pedestrian bicycle access and something that's often unremarked as well. 24 people gave their lives building that old bridge, and we did not have any construction fatalities, knock on wood, on the job site here during the length of that construction. So I wanted to provide this for you. You know, we could have done it maybe a couple of meetings from now, but I thought while it's fresh in our minds, it would be good to share with you some of the insights that we shared with the Senate Transportation Committee in terms of what this project has meant over its long maturation in terms of cost and schedule. And I think the value that we have added and the pride I hope that you take, despite the leak stories every once in a while, in what we accomplished in opening this new structure. That's it, Mr. Chairman.
Thanks, Steve. Can you go back to the four? You had it there just a little bit ago. One more.
You mean the one where they're all summed up?
Where they're all summed up, yeah.
There it is.
You know, obviously you couldn't tell because of the political, the political delays. But I think with the public, I mean, this is a good postmortem. This, kind of gives us an indication of, of what's going on, and it helps. But this data, we've had this data here for a long time. And I think from a public standpoint that it would have been nice to have been able to have this earlier. We know that I think in the future that there's going to be detours, and of course probably not going to have many bridge replacements, but on major projects where you do, where you're replacing something, that those things ought to be included. Now in hindsight, we ought to be including those in our estimates.
Yeah, I do think that's absolutely true. And Peter, if you go back to the detour slide itself, the biggest single cost here is the detour we had at Yerba Buena Island, the infamous S-curve. One of the first things we did as an oversight committee is wrestle with the question of, could we avoid that cost altogether? Now, that would have meant closing the bridge for many, many months. And that's a tough one. In today's world, in today's economy, as critical as this bridge is, we made the decision that you can't. We tried to get it down to 6 months. I thought if we could just close the bridge 6 months, maybe we could tolerate that, right? We lived without it for a month after the earthquake, but we couldn't get it below a year, and so that led to a decision that said you got to spend $500 million to get traffic around there while you're still building. And Mr. Chairman, you're absolutely right. That I'm sure was not figuring in the cost estimator's mind when they came up with that $650 million many moons ago.
Very good. Commissioner Spearing?
Steve, thanks for the report. I don't think there's very few people in the Bay Area that didn't expect this bridge to cost a hell of a lot more than it was estimated in all these escalations in costs. What the real rub is that you're spending $6 billion on a bridge and you have failed bolts, you got a deck that's leaking. That's the stuff that the public is really kind of irritated about. And to me, and Andy, your presentation when you talked about the barrier on the Benicia Bridge isn't leaking, but the one on the new bridge is, So you got to say, why is that? Why weren't they looking at what was used on the other bridge? And that's, that's kind of what the person on the street is thinking. I notice in the report, Steve, where it talks about it's not an engineering audit, that they're really talking about process and what happened, how the decisions were made. I kind of sense that you shot over Caltrans' bow this morning with your comments. And, to me, I think there's a lot of blame to go around. And is there going to be a report that actually talks about how the decisions were made? And, when you look at the history of the bolts, I mean, that really should have been, the way I see it, that should have been caught somewhere in that process. And, so I'm hoping that we're going to do some type of report that will actually talk about the process or how these decisions were made, how they can be avoided. I think that from the hearing, I kind of got the impression that that's what they were looking for, is that we'd come back with that we'd have these lessons learned more on the process, not on the construction of the bridge or the cost overruns. But I'm hoping that we're going to do that and really take a look at it, so in future projects we have a reference that we can look at and say, here's how some of these things can be checked or reviewed. And we brought in all that peer review after the fact. I kind of wish that was done in the front end of the process. And so I'm just hoping that more is going to come out of this than just talking about the cost that we're talking about the process, about how we how these decisions were made and how this bridge developed over time.
Commissioner, we will. I think the chairman's right, though. We're probably not going to be building a lot of these big bridges in the next few years, but the next one we do build, we ought to learn these lessons. I will tell you at the hearing, the two main issues that were talked about, and they got quite a bit of press coverage, so you're aware of them, are the quality of the welds in the deck panels that we got from Shanghai and the bolts and the rods, which you all have sat through in gruesome detail. And as you know, on the latter question, we have completed a preliminary report on the bolts and what happened and what went wrong. And that's an indication that that's actually a good example to me of that decision was made prior to the creation of the Oversight Committee. Now, I can't sit here and guarantee to you that we would have caught that problem, but we would have had a chance. As it was, that decision was made with very little transparency and visibility. I don't think it was adequately challenged or vetted. And we ended up, as you say, with all the peer review after the fact, trying to come up with a strategy to replace the bolts that failed and assure ourselves that the remaining bolts are going to be okay. On the deck welds in China, actually that problem occurred after the committee, the Oversight Committee, was created. And what mystified me about the hearing is that the two gentlemen who were testifying were portrayed as whistleblowers. You know, well, whistleblowers usually are people who come up with something that's been suppressed and hidden. The whistle on those welds had blown at high noon. Everybody knew we had a problem. There were 50 people over there who knew we had a problem. Our committee visited that fabrication facility a couple different times. I think Chairman Dodd was along on one of those trips. And we were working that problem aggressively, and we ended up with a report about a phone book thick about how we get ourselves through that and how we accept the welds that we needed to accept, and we moved on. So I think those two examples, again, show you that when you have a level of oversight and public accountability and regular reporting, it's not like problems don't happen, but you manage them so much differently than when it's just one organization which does not report to a board, and those decisions get made internally and never get challenged and really don't get vetted.
Good. Anybody else?
Thank you, Chair. Steve, I just wanted to kind of follow up on some of your comments, and I really concur that and part of this hearing, I think, was for future large projects. I know they're building a bridge in Los Angeles. They're doing other large construction projects, but I think that you showed appropriately the difference between, you know, when after the TBPOC was established and there was a public oversight, public discussion. I think that was evident last spring when the issue of the bolts came out. We were able to discuss that in public, have the information available to the public, have them participate in that discussion. And so people were able to understand the issues and have confidence in the solution. I guess the question that I wanted to follow up with, and I'm hopeful that in working with Caltrans, there will be, in the future, this ongoing robust discussion when problems occur. Because obviously, as you indicated, our ability in the TBPOC to function, this commission to oversee the bridge is only as good as the information that we get from the people that are on the ground. So I really wanted to concur that I think it's really important that that is important in terms of moving forward, that there really be a robust, you know, sharing of information as the problems, you know, evolve. So I appreciate your thoughts too, that we'll be seeing more of a detailed punch list so that we can address these issues and bring them forward at whatever level they need to be discussed.
We will be. I mean, look, I'll just state the obvious. We are clearly we're on the downward slope of this project. So a lot of the issues and the heartache that we've been through is behind us. I think the important point about this transition from construction to maintenance, though, is that we don't accept a lot of construction problems into the maintenance program and try to work them that way, that we get them fixed now before we finish the structure. And round numbers, that's looking like late summer in terms of the SAS. So that's our deadline, if you will, for making sure that we've got the construction program understood, that we've got the maintenance responsibility understood before it transitions from construction into really something that, as Andy said, we're entirely responsible for financially.
Great. If I may follow up just with one other question. So I assume that in that transition period, as we've discussed in the past, included will be kind of the public discussion and presentation of what this the maintenance manual will be, what the maintenance protocols will be, so that we're able to, you know, continue to monitor the health and making sure that the bridge is performing the way, you know, we expect it to.
Well, and I will say that this is back on Commissioner Sparing's point. You know, one other process lesson we learned, and this may be one that, that Bijan, that resonates with him as well, when the state set up its part of the toll bridge retrofit, the oversight committee process, it essentially created the toll bridge unit as separate and apart from the usual Caltrans structure. And that unit reports directly to the director of the department, which is very unusual. That essentially meant it bypassed the district. But guess who is going to maintain that bridge? It's going to be District 4 maintaining that bridge. So I'm not sure that decision was altogether thought through, because our maintenance partner really is a very important component of your construction operation. And I think one thing we've got to do that, you know, Andy and I have both been out in that bridge deck walking it the last few days, we got to get Caltrans maintenance out there a lot more than they've been, because to them it's still a construction zone, you know. But the fact is we've got a lot of work with District 4 and their maintenance folks to make sure that we're all ready for this transition when it occurs.
Okay. Commissioner Campos.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just a quick question, Steve. Thank you for the presentation. I think it's good to get some of the details as to why costs are so high. But after all these years and all these lessons that have been learned, I'm still very troubled by the fact that as we're transitioning from construction to maintenance, that you still had a situation where you weren't told of a problem that Caltrans knew in late December and you weren't told until January. I mean, how does that happen? I mean, it seems to me that that points to the fact that we still haven't learned some lessons in terms of better communication. And that's just very, you know, it's kind of scary to think about.
Commissioner, I mentioned it to you all because I'm very troubled by it too. I'm going to pursue a solution to it. And one thing we've done is formally request the information on any other like situation. Look, if anyone should have learned a lesson by now after almost 20 years on this project, it's err on the side of telling people more information, not less. Someone apparently made a decision they didn't think this was important enough to tell us. Well, guess what? Someone at Caltrans thought it was important enough to leak to the Chronicle, because that's how it wound up in the newspaper. And that person's judgment on this question was better than the person who didn't tell us. So we are going to do our dead-level best to get that corrected. And, look, I've worked with 8 different Caltrans directors on this project, and it's ebbed and flowed. And we've had better information flow with some than others. That's been one of the challenges. All I can tell you today is I am also troubled, and I'm going to work for some solutions to it. And look, it's not like you never find out. That's the crazy thing about this. I think we'll get to the bottom of it, but it is disturbing, and it's not the first time it's happened.
Mayor Kwan first, then Commissioner
Perez. I know we've gone through a lot of these different things. I guess I've now been on the commission for a year. There's been a series of things, and some of them happened before I was on. So I guess in this transition, which is going to be what, sometime in the next year? Right.
Yes.
That is, I guess, after the old bridge is taken down?
Well, not exactly. I think the transition really occurs when we get construction complete on the new bridge. And now that I think about it, Andy, it's not just the SAS. We've got to get part of this demolition work is actually to finish the new bridge. And right. That finishing means that new on-ramp that we'll have at Yerba Buena Island, as well as getting the bike path all the way. But when the SAS contract is complete, we're substantially done. And I think we will have 95% of the maintenance issues identified that we're going to need to deal with. And that will occur, again, round about the end of summer this year.
So at that time, we will also have some understanding of whether or not there was any liability in terms of construction, like on the welds, et cetera, all that. So
the welds, I don't think there's a liability issue because we fixed them before they set sail. All the press accounts that you were reading were about issues that happened in the fabrication shop, and the relevant fact there is not whether we had trouble with the welds, because we did. It's did we fix them before they sailed to the bay, and so, we did.
So we're sure that we fixed most of the welds, and we have the bolt issue. And
The bolt issue, Commissioner, is different, because as you recall, our report did identify three responsible parties.
Right.
And we are pursuing reimbursement from all three of them for the cost of
And so that was one of my questions. So we have multiple things happening here. We have some new issues that we're going to have to pursue that might require more maintenance. We have some liability issues that we're going to settle. And then we have maintenance. And I guess one of the questions I want to know is, will we expect to have higher maintenance because of some of these issues or not? And I don't want to hear the answer now, but for it all to come together, like I'm trying to put it all together, and I bet for the public that they don't, because there's been so many different reports, different issues. If the public's not following, which have been resolved, which haven't been resolved, I just would like that in the summer when we do the transition, use that as an opportunity to make clear what has been resolved, what liability issues we've resolved, and what maintenance issues we think we have going forward. Because I think those are the three themes that come out in the articles, right? That, although we have lots of little reports, and today we don't have a lot of media here, but those are the themes that come up. And as we know, people don't read a lot these days. They get most stuff off the electronic media. And so I think and to build the community trust with the people of the Bay Area, if we can make that as clear as possible at the transition point when people are paying attention again, that would be a good thing to do.
Mr. Chairman, I mean, given the level of interest in that question, I think we probably should come back to you with some kind of briefing on the maintenance issue in general. And just as a look ahead, we do expect this summer to be the time when the bolt testing that we've had underway for several months now sort of runs its course, and that issue comes to a head about how many of the remaining bolts that have not broken should be replaced as a precautionary measure or not. I will say the testing is going quite well in the sense that most of the bolts we're testing are standing up very well to the test. But we'll have to be making those decisions around about the summertime as well.
Commissioner Brzezinski.
Thank you, Chair. Steve, again, to staff, great presentation. Really good to come up to speed on this. I think to follow on Mayor Kwan's comments, ultimately, our public needs to know a macro issue, and that is this bridge safe? And every one of these items, whether it's in the punch list or something that we didn't expect from engineering, as it goes into the public forum through the media, needs to be addressed in that context. When you drive across that bridge, you're going to make it to the other side. Now, I'm fully confident that when I do, I will. But for me, it's a matter of communication, how we communicate, what the reality is, how we contextualize every one of these issues in the context of the macro safety of the bridge. we live in an environment, particularly with the social media, there where every single error is broadcast as life-threatening, the end of the world, or whatever. We see it in our own counties and our own cities. And I think it's really important that the communication be clear, not defensive, not accusatory of who's going to take the blame, as much as how does this issue fit into the larger context of bridge safety? Because if we don't do that, then we start to diminish the credibility of all of our organizations. So I would make the recommendation that we look very carefully at our messaging from this point. I know we do already, but develop a messaging program whereby we answer immediately in the context of how significant is this issue relative to the larger issue of bridge safety.
Commissioner, very good point. And let me just take this opportunity in response to your question to state unequivocally, this bridge is safe. And none of the issues we've been discussing today compromise safety. And the best safety decision that we made in the last couple years is opening this bridge on Labor Day and not waiting around to some other time.
Anybody else? Dan? Okay, we do have one speaker card. David, thanks for your patience.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. David Schoenbrunn, Transdev. That was a very informative and substantive presentation, and I appreciate it. I have a question about the Richmond-San Rafael Bridge. I looked through the project update and did not see any reference to work that's currently ongoing around the toll plaza. You have an item before the PAC later this morning about allocating $70 million of BATA funds to adding a third lane to the eastbound direction. And I have not found any information about the project scope, but it appears to me to be bizarre that a three-lane bridge is being connected to by a current project with apparently only two lanes capacity. And I would very much appreciate if your staff could get back to me with information about project scope. But it appears to me this may have been a bad judgment on the part of when this project was approved, because we're now fixing it, or we're proposing to fix it to deal with having three lanes on the Richmond Bridge. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay. I suppose staff can get to him on that. Thank you very much, David. I have no other speaker cards. Just check one. Yes, I do. Excuse me. We do have a public comment right now, and Ken Bukowski has asked to speak.
Hi. My name is Ken Bukowski. I'm a retired mayor and city council member. And just for the purposes of the audience, I'm video recording these meetings. They are available on YouTube, onebayarea.us on YouTube. And you'll find all the MTC and ABAG meetings. And if you guys don't show up for a meeting, you can go back and see what happened without you being there. Thank you.
Thank you, Ken. Okay, that concludes the meeting today. And the next meeting of the BATA Oversight Committee will be Wednesday, March 5th, 2014 at 9:30. Thank you.